new stuff all the time. He gets social information about the dogs in his neighborhood, just like I get when I check Twitter or Instagram. You know, it's smelling is a vital part of his doghood, and it's crucial then for me to respect that and to give him opportunities to use his nose.
As a pup parent myself, do you know what he sees?
One thing he sees is fewer colors than I do. So a dog's, it's a common myth that dogs don't see color at all, but they do see from, but they do see colors. It's just a limited rainbow. So reds will look like a dark yellow to Typo. Some greens will just look like gray. A lot of purples and violets will look dark blue. So his rainbow really just goes from yellow to blue with some whites and grays in the middle.
That's Ed Yong, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer at The Atlantic. His book, An Immense World, How Animal
Senses Reveal... We're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You've stepped up and helped us meet two matches already on the way to our $70,000 end-of-year drive goal. Now, in the last week of 2022, we've got another special incentive to help us finish strong. Contribute at kboo.fm/give by December 31st, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $5,000 thanks to the generous support of Garnier Vineyards. All donations will be matched, even if you've already given this year. Make one last contribution to KBOO in 2022 at kboo.fm/give right now.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Althea Billings, and this is a special end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO News. It's Monday, December 26th. Tonight, we've got a special look back for you at some of our favorite news in-depth pieces this past year. But first, as I mentioned, this is our end-of-year membership drive, and it is our final week. KBOO and KBOO News are a critical resource for the communities that we serve, and we rely on support from listeners and members like you to continue to offer radio training and daily news broadcasts. Now is an important time to contribute because every dollar counts. We have a goal of $70,000 to raise before the end of the year. kboo.fm/give is the link to donate online, or you can text KBOO to 44321 to get more information on how to donate. Thank you so much for your support. Let's get into some of our favorite news in-depth pieces from 2022.
Welcome to this News in Depth here on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland Radio. I had a chance to speak with Hannah Gadsby, comedian, writer, and creator of the Netflix comedy specials Nanette and Douglas. Welcome, Hannah Gadsby.
Thank you.
We are very excited to have you in Portland, Oregon, a town that adores you. So your current show, Body of Work, can you talk a little bit about how it was created and how it is to present this one?
Yeah, look, created or incubated at the tail end of lockdown in Australia, which was, you know, a far different experience, I understand, than the American quilted service you had here. It began in Australia. It was supposed to be an intense city hopping tour that ended up being like this really extended thing because of various lockdowns and state restrictions and things. So it began like no other show I've ever done. Usually I work up a show in a small venue for a month, I guess, and then start touring and fiddling on the road, as you say. Well, you shouldn't probably say that, could be twisted out of context. And so this is I sort of had to do these shows sort of cold quite a lot, because I'd do one show and then wouldn't do another one for a month, and then just head into these big venues and go, oh, I hope this is up to standard. But of course people have been locked up, so they're just happy to be there.
Would you say that your audiences have changed internationally since Nanette blew up?
Yes, well, I mean, I have an international audience now. Before Nanette went onto Netflix, I was really only an Australian and UK performer. I'm only really known in those circles. Of course, you know, anyone who came on the festival circuits in those two places. So I have an international audience now. Apparently, I have quite a big following in South America and India. That's a huge difference. Sometimes I don't know who my audience is and what they want from me. I guess if I was to think about the specifics of all my audience, then I think that would send me into a bit of a tailspin mentally. So, you know, I do struggle a little bit with being, you know, becoming generic. Do I have, you know, gosh, will I have to talk about the difference between cats and dogs? Which is an infinitely interesting topic, I'm sure, but I have a idiosyncratic life and identity, politics, I guess. So sometimes I do worry that, you know, the audience that I picked up during, you know, post-Nanette world, you know, perhaps what I have to say isn't what they're wanting to pick up anymore. But I guess you just have to keep using your voice as it feels right and be what may.
I'd like to ask about your writing process. Could you speak a little bit about how you structure your shows as you develop them?
All my shows throughout my career have always been built around the things that have been preoccupying me. And I always start out with a feeling that I want to achieve in the room. Then, you know, and then I come up with a structure that would help me achieve. So it's, for me, the way to achieve a feeling in a room with a room full of strangers, you need more than just, you know, meaning and words. I think the structure really, you know, needs to support what you're trying to achieve. So say with Nanette, I wanted, of course, to give a punch in the guts. Mm-hmm. And so the structure, you know, was very important in achieving that. With this show, I decided I wanted to do a feel-good show. I want to leave audiences feeling good. And, you know, there's as I'm touring, you know, I am struggling with that a little bit because it feels like an indulgence, and perhaps you should be talking about all the issues. Oh, so many issues.
Yeah.
So many things wrong with the world right now. But then again, I sort of think, you know, maybe an openly queer person being openly honest about feeling openly good is in itself a political statement in this climate. So the structure of this show does sort of evolve to accommodate that tension between sort of, you know, this is a feel-good show, but if you look sideways out of your own sort of bubble of loveliness, there's always something crowding in. So there's these little, the tension has become a hallmark of this show as well, I guess.
Presenting a comedy show about love in a moment of legislating homophobia seems to represent that tension and make it even more palpable.
Yes, well, I think, you know, particularly because the homophobic angle at this point in time has claimed victimhood. And so I think to produce a piece of art that is not positioning itself in the binary of that, you know, not even engaging in that conversation, you know, is, I think, a relief for me personally. You know, I don't want to be dictated by the talking points of you know, the homophobic right. I do struggle. I do struggle with the personal and the public.
What are your thoughts about young people right now?
You know, I think we're aging quicker. I think we've got a generation, you know, in their between their mid-30s and, you know, late 40s, which I'm smack bang in the middle of. We're neither young nor old, but we are sort of old because we're raised on a technology and a form of communication that is obsolete. And that technological obsolete, I have wrong verbiage there, whatever. That took, you know, a century before. Like, my grandmother was not obsolete until the tail end of her life.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm kind of becoming a Luddite, smack bang in the middle, where I've got the most to offer a younger generation. Yet I don't feel like I actually have anything to offer because I was raised on such different social dynamics. So I don't feel like I can genuinely give decent advice to younger people. I think the only principle, I guess, I'm working on that level is that, you know, I guess I have a semblance of power. And the only good thing you can do with power is to be willing to give it up. And that's sort of what I'm working on. Like, I feel like, you know, the younger generation, they're gonna be picking up the weight that we leave behind. Like, I think holding on to power makes that a far heavier and far more damaging burden than it needs to be. So basically, it's like, I don't know what you're going to do, guys, but I want to help.
Well, it also speaks to the strength of you bringing your personal experience of the world forward, and at the same time not embracing that power over.
Well, this is interesting because, you know, just 5 or 6 years ago, I almost felt like my experience was irrelevant. You know, growing up in the 90s in a deeply, you know, homophobic conversation. And now all of a sudden, that very same, you know, homophobic conversation has been sort of superimposed almost word for word, beat for beat, argument to argument onto the trans community. So, you know, in a sense, you know, I can't speak. You know, I'm genderqueer, absolutely, but I'm not trans, so I don't feel equipped to speak to the trans experience, except that I completely do understand that minimizing language, that dangerous rhetoric, that, you know, that's inching, well, not even inching, it's galloping into, legal sort of, oppression at a time when, you know, trans people are trying to form a solid identity, you know, like trans, you know, has always existed. Mm-hmm. Variation in gender has always existed, but we're now sort of the collective cultural experience going, and we have, you know, we're seeing this. So the, you know, these two things happening at the same time is what I felt, you know, when I was younger, you know, trying to develop a language around being queer in a place that refused to believe that queer people existed. But all the all the subtleties of that experience are completely different in a world that is so hyper-connected. So I grew up in complete isolation. So, you know, there are things that, you know, I don't understand about the experience of the younger generation.
Well, one of the things that stood out to me about that talk was such a beautiful idea that you brought forward of don't panic, who do you want to be, and sort of the permission to live in the question. I thought it was a very powerful statement.
I think there's so much pressure to be very certain about your opinions about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And you know, Brit just bringing it back to that that question, you know, who do you want to be, you know, what sort of person do you want to be, should, you know, that should drive your action. And that sort of diffuses the, you know, I think personally, I find it diffuses that impulse to be, didactic, you know, and closes your mind to curiosity. And every situation is different. You can't be the same person in every situation.
It reminds me of my other question I had for you is about how you manage your specific needs as such a public person now. How has managing that changed over time? Where's that now?
I feel like the intensity has dropped off. You know, I'm not the topic of the moment anymore, which I find a great relief. I find the parasocial demands on public figures now just, mm-hmm. it's not actually sustainable for me. Mm-hmm. I understand how it works and I understand how it can be utilized to keep, you know, propelling a career forward, but I just don't actually think I have it in me. I just feel my life force draining away. I get confused about what, you know, I'm autistic. I don't understand what people want at the best of times, let alone online, people I've never met and I don't understand. So I don't feel like I'm the, you know, right temperament for this moment in time as a public figure, but I feel fine about that as an artist. I feel like, you know, I'm not worried about my profile. I'm not worried about my, you know, I just feel like it gives me a little breath to really think about, you know, who I want to be. I take a lot more in than I give out, which I think is a good balance for an artist.
So can I ask a little bit, go back to sort of the craft aspect of things? Like you were saying, I guess my question is sort of, how do you decide something is funny when you're writing it?
Well, it's an instinct, I guess. You know, I'm like a little bower bird. You know, I collect things.
You collect?
yeah, I'm not just collecting, you know, when it's time to write a show. Like, things are always preoccupying me. I have, you know, and things are always happening in life. So you always have a story that you can build a show around. That's, mm-hmm. And, you know, so, and an audience always guides you. You know, it's a very interesting space, because the audience will tell you what's funny. But that's less true the more successful you get. Audiences who pay, you know, tickets to see you, like, you know, see you and you alone, are very different to people who just rock up to comedy clubs, not knowing who you are or who's even going to be on the bill. The expectations are very different, and the resistance is very different. You don't get any resistance from people who are there to see you. Like, you have to do something drastically wrong to lose an audience that have, you know, that you've already convinced, you know, of your worth. So, you know, you don't have to work as hard to, you know, at the top of a performance, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. people are like, we like you, we trust you, we're on it, you know, we feel like we're on the same page. Look, we've already made the effort to be here for you. And that puts such a lovely energy in the room. It's a real privilege, you know, mm-hmm. that I've gotten later in my career. So I'm, you know, I've lived a long time in the other side of that equation. So you have to be, but I feel like I have to be careful with that, because they, you know, mm-hmm. people will laugh at anything in a big room when they're all excited, you know, like, you can't necessarily rely on what, you know, so it takes, you know, and people in different places laugh at different things, which I find endlessly fascinating. So, you know, you have to sort of, it's a dance, really. Sometimes I say things and people laugh and I really don't know what exactly it is they're laughing at. And I keep those lines in and they consistently get laughs, and I don't understand why. I think it's the rhythm. Sometimes something just has a rhythm and it doesn't make sense. Like, if you think about what someone has said, you're like, that doesn't even make sense.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about it from your perspective, though, about when you're writing something, do you take delight in something, and does that translate, or does it sometimes not match at all?
I love puns to a degree that I have to scale it back for public performance. You know, like, that's just, people don't like, generally speaking, don't like as many puns as I do. So if I, you know, had my way, I'd be dad joke central. But, so, you know, it's a give and take. Yeah, it's a conversation. Comedy is a conversation. It is not a script. It's a very live and dynamic thing. So a lot of what you say has been said before, and you deliver it with the same rhythms, but those rhythms are developed in front of an audience. And it is always dynamic and needs to be flexible. Sometimes as a tour progresses, a piece of material will just stop working. And I think that puts down to, because you're not living live in it anymore, you're just like, well, that's settled now, and then the audience stops believing you.
It's such an interesting way. You're really helping me understand that there's this kind of dialogue that you work on through the audience reaction.
Like, it's always evolving.
Yeah, I can see why it always feels alive then. So one last question.
Sure thing.
Okay, so is there art or music or particular creative endeavors happening right now that you're finding inspiration or solace in?
Well, I don't have my finger on the pulse at the moment, because I'm in the middle of a tour, and it is a really, really sort of combative experience for me. Like, I really struggle with where I am on the spectrum. It's not an ideal environment. So I keep my world fairly small, but I've 2 television shows piggybacking, Succession and Bluey. So I guess you know Succession, because everyone seems to know Succession.
Mm-hmm.
But do you know Bluey?
I don't.
Well, let me tell you about Bluey. Bluey is a children's television show made in Australia. Anyone with kids knows Bluey. Like, everyone around the world. There are American kids who are mm-hmm. developing an Australian accent. So it's a family of dogs, healers, Australian healers. They're uh-huh. sheep dogs. Anyway, just facts. But it's an animation series, and it's just they go for 7 or 8 minutes, and it's just a delightful show. And it's almost the opposite kind of family dynamic to Succession, which is like
Succession is so dark.
Oh, it's you know, it's toxic power, you know. Mm-hmm. And but Bluey is just like cute little dogs that show their emotions by wagging their tails, and it's just like, well, I can read that. So it's like, but it's kind of the extremes. I was going to say the extremes of human experience, but you know, the one is dogs.
Yeah.
But I highly recommend it.
It sounds like a tonic.
It helps me because I'm homesick, but it's also just a delightful little world.
Yeah, that was my last question was, wait, you have dogs, don't you? Are you missing your dog?
Yeah.
Aww,
They're fine. I've raised them to be, you know, independent souls. They're good. You know, I think they remember me when they see me again. They're being well looked after. A dear friend of mine is co-owning them just sensationally.
But Bluey helps you get through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, really good. Well, thank you for the recommendation. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Pleasure. And we will very much look forward to seeing you in Portland.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
This is a KBOO News end of year special, looking back at 2022. It is also our end of year membership drive, and now is a great time to help us reach our fundraising goal of $70,000. If you've appreciated KBOO this year, if our newscast helps keep you informed, and if there's, you know, any show that you love at this station, now's a great time to consider giving back. Even $5 makes a huge difference for us, not just to keep KBOO going for another 54 years, but to also better our programs and better serve our community. Help us out this holiday season, kboo.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321. Let's get back to it.
From May 31st until September 10th, Portland will be home to a dinosaur museum. But if you're picturing a hushed building full of giant skeletons and roped-off displays, you might have the wrong idea.
The Spinosaurus that we have is about 8 feet tall, but they were apparently about 40 feet tall, so that's our biggest scientific mistake. Don't tell anyone.
Dinolandia is a cartoon dinosaur museum, full of quirky, cute, and often drooling wooden dinosaurs. It's the creation of local Portland artist Mike Bennett.
Hello there, I'm Mike Bennett. I'm an illustrator, public joy creator, and curator of Dinolandia.
Earlier this week, I got the chance to take a sneak peek at the museum and to chat with Mike about where it all came from.
Yeah. So what are we looking at here?
So we're standing in the lobby of Dinolandia, which is meant to look like a natural history museum. Right at dusk. So you're here in the evening, not typical museum hours. You're here for a reason, but you're not quite sure why yet. So
okay.
We're surrounded by skulls and fossils and all sorts of like gems and skeletons.
Wow. Yeah.
This building is 22,000 square feet. And it's about as full as I think I physically could have gotten it in 2.5 months with the help of tons of great humans who were willing to spend the last few months with me. But I can't imagine going much bigger than this with plywood. I mean, how could we not do dinosaurs in a building of this size?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think I know a person who hears the word dinosaur and doesn't think about like some mystery that is yet to be solved. It's such an interesting world. This area we're in is kind of if you're at a theme park, you have the boring line outside.
Yeah.
And then you get inside and you get the more themed line. So there's a couple like I Spy games in here, and then a bunch of TVs that'll have videos of us digging up fake cartoon fossils. So.
Some of the inspiration for the museum's design comes from immersive environments like theme parks and the haunted houses Mike went to growing up.
I mean, any theme park is for me. Like, it doesn't even have to have roller coasters. I just want to see immersive space design. Growing up on the East Coast, I feel like haunted house attractions were like huge in the fall, because of the beautiful foliage and nice weather. So like in Pennsylvania, everywhere you turned, there was a haunted attraction. And I was obsessed with the fact that this Kmart was now like a haunted prison or whatever, you know? So like in college, the feeling I would get knowing that on Saturday, we're going to Chambersburg to Field of Screams, like it was something that I can't replicate, but I want it to be for everyone. I don't need it to be scary. So as you approach the giant logo, you'll be escorted into Professor Rex Bennett's laboratory. So this professor is really, it's not an official museum. He kind of funded it himself, and he's really sick of these dusty old fossils. So he built the Findo Dino, which is a time machine that allows you to go back and visit dinosaurs as they once lived. And as the Findo Dino opens, you get to enter it, and you'll learn about some rules in this video that tell you to press these two buttons at the exact same time. If you don't, things might not work out. So, as we press them.
Mike says he's always loved cartoons.
After school for me growing up was kind of watching Animaniacs or whatever was on in the 90s.
But the large public cartoons on plywood he's become known for around Portland came about sort of by accident.
I made a snowman from Calvin and Hobbes because we had wood in our under our porch that I wanted to fit in our Honda Fit, and it did not fit. So I borrowed a jigsaw from my neighbor, and I was like, well, I've never used one of these. I'm gonna hurt myself. And I realized that you could, like, it was like butter. So I was like, oh, I could draw with this. That'd be really cool. It's a better way than just getting rid of the wood and taking it to Rebuilding Center or whatever. So I made a snowman from Calvin and Hobbes and put it outside, and it showed up on Reddit and like the Hidden Portland for the Curious Facebook page, and I was like, oh, this is cool. And I'm like forcing these cartoons on people. And it's kind of cool, like around every corner, you could never know what you're gonna find. And that was kind of my inspiration for a while. Was, what if I just hide Big Bird in Alberta Park and see what happens? And inevitably they disappear, but for some people they just get like a surprise.
And Dinolandia will be full of more surprises.
And the doors will open to reveal this beautiful Technicolor space with a bunch of dinosaurs.
Oh my god, here it is.
So you go from this kind of like dark black and white space downstairs to super colorful, fleshed out Dinolandia.
Oh my god.
So in the background you'll hear an original score written by Billy Kelly, who's a stand-up comedian and a Grammy-nominated children's musician. And he wrote this entire hour-long score for us. That's really, really something special. There's over 70 dinosaurs here, 50 different species. The number one question from kids seems to be, is there a T-Rex? And there is. It's almost 15 feet tall, surrounded by a couple of velociraptors, so pretty huge. My favorite part about this whole experience is like when I'm laying down to go to sleep and I'm feeling stressed and I can think, this is the most ridiculous thing I get to be stressed about. Like, I know I'm like, how do we put the T-Rex up tomorrow? This is gonna be so much work and we need to make sure we don't mess it up. But it's just like, I'm so thankful for what I get to be stressed about. Like really, that's what's getting me through it. Behind us now, we have a beautiful mural by Julia Hunkler, who put this incredible prehistoric Pacific Northwest landscape together. So it kind of looks like the wall is busted out. And we're looking over Mount Hood and the gorge as it once was. And there's a lot of hidden dinosaurs in here as well. So.
Oh, yeah. And the Columbia is sort of like rushing through the room.
It busted through the wall and now it's in our space. So.
Some of the areas in the museum are painted to look like places known for their dinosaur fossils, like Bryce Canyon. But there's also a pretty heavy Oregon theme.
And as we round the river bend here, there is a giant beaver.
Oregon isn't particularly well known for being home to any dinosaurs because it was underwater throughout most of the dinosaur age.
What they are known for is this prehistoric megafauna that resembled a beaver. So that beaver will have its own banner next to it to kind of explain why it's here and what that's all about.
That's great. I love it.
Then we're passing down the river and we have, this used to be a Banana Republic.
Oh, really?
So we have all these kind of fixtures to hide. So there's fitting rooms and this cash wrap we're standing next to. And as you round the corner here, we've got the giant volcano, which feels like an asset to any cartoon dinosaur experience.
Yeah.
So So as we enter the second fitting room hallway from the old space, we are in Cretaceous Curations, which is an art gallery that we repurposed a fitting room into. So there's 8 different artists in here. They were just given the theme of dinosaurs, and they got to roll with that.
One of the artists with a fitting room installation goes by the name Self-Drawn Suitcase.
I mean, technically my name's Sarah Murphy, but people call me Murph. I suppose I would call myself Mike's right-hand person, sort of the director's assistant. I help him with anything and everything that we do around here.
Murph's installation is full of more plywood dinosaurs, floating around at what looks like a birthday celebration, but is actually a sort of extinction party. A realistic cake is set in the back, frosted with the words, "Making the best of it."
Kind of sad party vibes, which I feel like is really relatable in the current times from the last couple of years. You know, we're all just trying to find joy where we can and make the best of it.
It turns out cartoon dinosaur museums are a relatively easy place to find joy.
It has been amazing. I think my favorite part was like the very loud, enthusiastic Britney Spears sing-alongs and things like that when we're all on ladders painting in different parts of the room and someone turns on some sort of 90s pop and everybody is just like belting it out and singing along. Yeah, and we, you know, we like carpooled to and from work every day for 3 months, and so there's just like exhausted fits of laughter in the car on the way home late at night, and it's great.
And aside from Murph and the other artists and Cretaceous Curations, there's also space to add more contributions to Dinolandia.
An evolving art display. So I said 8 artists, but really the goal is to have hundreds, because this is where we get to display all the kids' art that will inevitably show up.
Oh, that's great. So are kids welcome to bring dinosaur art?
We have a mailbox downstairs that I'm hoping after the first visit people will see and they'll remember to bring things in with them. But
yeah,
things